Welcome to All the Ways I've Failed. This podcast is recorded on the unceded lands of the Yugambeh people. We pay our respects to the traditional custodians and their continued connection to the land and sea on which we live, work and create. Hello there, my name is Beck Marshall-Say. I am a writer, an academic and the author of children's picture book Facing the Wave. All the Ways I've Failed is not only for writers but for anyone who creates, strives and fails along the way. Today I'm talking with Deborah Frankel, a children's picture book author of Natropolis and the Sydney Harbour Fairy. Thanks for joining me on All the Ways I've Failed, Deb.
No, thanks for having me, Beck. I'm really happy to chat to you about this.
Let's start with an icebreaker failure question I've been asking everyone. If I was to ask your friends or family about something that you are perhaps categorically not good at, is there something you are destined to fail at, a life skill or?
I have quite a few things that I'm destined to fail at, but one of them is spatial awareness. So you know how there's that cliche of the like extreme brain types, and one of the types is really linguistic and one of them is really spatial. So I'm the cliche of the one who's like really good at with words and stuff, but I'll like walk into a wall, or like if I you try and give me IKEA furniture to assemble, I'll just give up about a minute into it. So spatial awareness is not my forte. But it's quite good in my family because my husband is like the extreme spatial awareness end of the spectrum. So everything that requires anything to do with that, he does. So it's made me even worse at it over time, I think, to be honest.
Are you allowed to pack the dishwasher? I get banned from that.
I am allowed to pack the dishwasher, but my household is not very very finicky about things like that. So I can get all the dishwashing things in. I'm just not going to do it in a particularly efficient way.
I saw a meme that said in every relationship, there's one person who packs the dishwasher like a Swedish architect and another person who packs it like a raccoon on meth. And that is me. I'm the raccoon.
I'm the raccoon and proud of it.
I don't have time to do it any better than this. This is getting most of the job done. And if it doesn't get it done, it can have a second go as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. Correct. I absolutely 100% agree.
So your first book, Natropolis, was illustrated by Ingrid Bartkowiak and published by StoryTorch in 2023?
2022. Yep.
But you received some awards in 2023 for it?
Yeah, that's correct. So it in the CBCA awards last year, the Children's Book Council of Australia Awards, it received a notable award in one category, the information book category, and then it received actually a shortlist, which is the next level up. In the new illustrated category, which is amazing. Never something that I expected, but yeah, a bit of a bonus. And it also received an international award called the Nautilus Award, which is for books for a better world. It's an American-based but internationally open award, and it won a gold award in that, which was also extremely unexpected.
That's amazing. Yeah. What a way to start.
It was kind of a surprise, and I kind of went, you know how you start something new and you're never really entirely sure how these things work. It was quite eye-opening to me, I guess.
Do you think it set your expectations high? Did you ask?
It's probably extremely problematic, but like we've had this with a book that's my first book. I think with anything along those lines with awards and things like that, I mean, the vibe I get is that these things are super subjective. So, you know, it's not like a running race where clear who has come first. So I do try to keep that in mind with everything, that every stage of the publishing and writing process, things are subjective, which, let me know that again next time. Next time I'm stressing out about mental note.
What type of reader would enjoy Natropolis?
So it's a picture book that is a non-fiction picture book, but it's kind of a mixture of fiction and non-fiction. And it's basically all about the nature that surrounds us in the city. So it's the kind of book that, as a picture book, look, it's aimed at kids, but I think there's a strong adult appeal for the adult who's reading with the kid. I guess the kind of reader who would enjoy it is probably the reader who enjoys poring over the details of things. So Ingrid's illustrations are very intricate and she's zoomed in really close to the details of things. So there's a lot that you can, I think, get from the book on a second reading or a third reading too. But yeah, I think it's kind of a book for those who are interested in the little things, which hopefully is a lot of people.
Do you think it will Or have you received feedback that it encourages maybe young readers to go out and look at the world outside with that same kind of detailed lens?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I mean, I've done a number of school visits, and when we do an activity where we go outside and look to see what is around, even in the playground and so on, it's like it's fun for the kids, but it's just as much fun for me. Like the last one I did, we found like a tree that had a whole bunch of beetles like spawning all over it. So like eggs all over the leaves, but they were literally in the process of hatching as we were watching. And I was just like, this is amazing. Like, I would never have had an excuse to stand and watch beetles hatch out of eggs on the leaf before. Like, I think it's natural for kids to like looking at the small things. And I think maybe as adults, we sometimes forget that. But yeah, I mean, it's something that I'd like to think that this book is keeping that alive in many people of all ages.
So after setting the bar incredibly high with your first book, you then released The Sydney Harbour Ferry with completely reasonable expectations, illustrated by Kate James and published by Affirm Press. What sort of reader do you think will really enjoy The Sydney Harbour Ferry?
Yeah, so this is also a picture book, but it's quite different. It's a fictional story about a little girl going for a day out with her nana through and around Sydney Harbour. Look, it's a book that's much more lighthearted. It's about the bond between family members, and it's about maybe discovering that a family member you thought you knew and understood is a bit more than they seem. So yeah, I'd say it's a much more lighthearted book that's more about relationships. I think it's also a book that is very strongly a Sydney book. So I have had, you know, anecdotal feedback from people who are saying, yeah, like this is great to send to family members overseas. You know, it's got the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge. It's obviously got Sydney ferries in it too. So it's very much kind of full of those iconic things.
And the idea for the Sydney Harbour Ferry came from a bit of a parenting communication fail.
Yeah, a little bit. So when my daughter was, my daughter is now 6 and a half, but when she was quite little, we went to Sydney for a, I live in Melbourne. We went to Sydney for a family holiday. She got very excited about the idea of, we'd said to her, we're going to go on a ferry ride, and she got very excited and then got super disappointed when we got to Circular Quay, and she was like, it's a boat. And I went, oh, you thought it was like a ferry, like with wings flapping around. Yeah, that instantly sparked a story. I knew that there was something in that to play with. And the rest of it, to be honest, was a lot of it. So I grew up in Sydney. A lot of the ideas about going for a day out around Sydney Harbour are just a reflection of my experience as a kid too. Yeah, there's a lot in it, I guess, that has come from personal experience. But I feel like my writing is mostly like that. Generally, it's something my kids have said or something that I've been mulling over in my mind that I remember that is the kind of kicking off point.
I love that so much. One of my biggest disappointments as a kid was visiting Darwin with my grandparents, and my parents had gone off camping. I was quite little, and my whole family's from England, and my nana and papa probably more so than anyone else still use, you know, English over Australian terminology. And they told us we were going out for the day, we're going to go into the city and we're going to take the coach. And I was so excited. And I pictured this Cinderella ball coach. It was going to be amazing because they have the, you know, the footman and the coachman in all the Cinderella stories. And I thought it was going to be amazing. And I was just devastated when a bus turned up.
I feel like you've just come up with a sequel plot. But this is
the underwhelming coach trip to Darwin. Absolutely.
I feel like that's my strong memory of childhood, though, like a series of moments of expecting something absolutely magical and being completely, completely flattened when I discovered that the magical stuff was actually something very prosaic and ordinary.
So when you're writing, do you, especially, I guess now you have a couple of books, you know, under your belt, does that change how you feel about things like failure, or do you worry about failing any more or any less? Does it inoculate you in any way?
I think yes and no. I think the no part is that I do think it's very easy to get on a treadmill where you feel like as soon as you've ticked off one achievement on your theoretical achievements list, you instantly move on to the next, which I think is a really dangerous thing to kind of get in the habit of, because I know that I will, like, something good will happen and I will be happy for literally about 10 seconds and then I'll go, right, but I still haven't achieved this, which is terrible. But at the same time, I think having a couple of books out there has given me the confidence to know that I can get from the beginning of a story to the end and create something that is publishable and commercial enough to become a real book. So I think yes and no. I think in one hand, I mean, it's like what we were mentioning about the awards. By achieving one thing, I think there is a subconscious almost expectation that you go, all right, well, I've ticked that off. Now I need to go into the next step on the ladder, which is, I think, a wrong assumption to make, because there is no ladder, right? Like it's not like everything you're doing is necessarily building on the thing you've done before.
Yeah, I think it's very easy once you have something out, or you've made, got a certain level of achievement or a certain level of, you know, success or recognition, that you, if you have a different experience with your next book or your next process, it's really easy to compare it and think, well, maybe it's not as good, or maybe I didn't. So my big thing is, you know, you have one book out, and I was really fortunate that I was picked up off my very first submission. And then since then, you go back into that normal process of, you know, rejections and submissions. And there's that part of you that goes, you know, well, you're partly confident that it will happen again, even if it takes time, I can do this. And then on the other hand, you go, what if that's it? What if I'm just this, you know, incredible one-hit wonder? And that feels almost even scarier or more embarrassing that you...
100%. Like one thing I was going to say was that, like, I feel like I'm like, okay, I've got two picture books in the world. I've got two out next year, and I've got two others in various stages of production that are under contract, but I'd really like to write something longer. For me, I'm like, I'm kind of going, wow, I can't write anything longer than a picture book now, because that's, my brain has gone, this is what you can do. That's it. And it's kind of drawn a fence around it. So I think there's a danger in that too, to kind of go, sure, you've had quote unquote success about one thing, but it kind of almost implies that all the other things that you haven't done yet are not kind of within that sort of that scope of possibility, which I think is a danger.
You begin to downplay your own achievements, and you know that you go, I can write a picture book, and picture books are incredibly difficult, but I can't write a longer book. I couldn't write a novel for
adults. I'm not really a writer.
Even though it's competitive, even though writing succinctly, writing for kids is such a skill and a talent, and you know that, and it's the type of thing that you would tell other writers in your, you know, critique group, or you would tell your friends if they were writing. But when it comes to yourself, you go, I can't do that though. Totally. And if I try that, I'm definitely going to fail. Do you think that fear of failure holds you back with your writing?
I think it did for a really long time. I was like, so I really loved writing as a kid and a teenager. And for some reason I stopped when I finished school and didn't really start again until I was on mat leave with my first child. So it was like 10 plus years. And yeah, I think it was fear of failure, in the sense that I needed to have some kind of external validation to provide permission to continue on with it. So yeah, I mean, there's probably a lot to unpack there, like psychologically, with the reason why. Like, I don't know if you were the same, but anecdotally, I hear of many women who are writers who have kids seem to only pick up a pen again after a long hiatus during mat leave, or, you know, after having kids. And I feel like that's so interesting. Like, I'm the epitome of that.
It's such a cliche.
And, you know, like, I think in high school, I would have been like, you know, the kid most likely to become a writer. Like, I was writing all the time. I was, you know, that was what I was really good at. And for some reason, I finished school and I went, oh, well, I no longer have anyone asking me to do this for class. I guess I won't do it. Boggles my mind now.
I feel like you can look back and go, I wasted time, but I feel like you wasted time as well, because you go, I've got lots of time. It will definitely happen. I don't think you probably appreciate the sort of hard work and the fact that you need to carve out time for these things to happen. And you spend all that time and years, you know, in your head or having it. So I have lots of very, very neglected manuscripts of different, all adult, you know, in different states of disrepair on my computer. And I would pick up a notebook, or I would just buy lots of new stationery and look at it and go, oh, this could be a best-selling novel. You never know. And then you didn't want to taint it with your own drivel, so it sort of sits there unopened. But yes, I was exactly the same. I had a baby. I was rocking my baby. I was reading picture books, and I was thinking about you know, the challenges he might face, and literally wrote it while rocking him to sleep. And, you know, I was humming a picture book sort of rhyme scheme, and this story literally just sprung into my mind, and I wrote it on my phone and wrote it while he was sleeping and things like that. But I think,
and did that become your first book, or did that become Facing the Wave? Wow.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Case in point.
Because I thought he's going to, and I was one of those kids that was probably really enthusiastic about doing things, but sometimes was scared about it anyway. And I'd be really brave with some things, and then there'd be some things, and I'm still like that with surfing, and I love it. But sometimes I go out and I go down, I'm like, hopefully, usually surf with a group to make sure I go, and hopefully it will be called off. And I love it. I always love it when I get out there. I'm a good swimmer. I'm not afraid, but I can't, you know, you can't pin you. It is the fear of failure. It's the fear of going out there and struggling and not being able to get out the back, or, you know, I don't know what it is. It's really hard to put your finger on. Anyway, I thought about, you know, my kid having all these things, and that's where that came from. But my completely unqualified psychoanalysis of that is that
I'm all for that.
Is I think it, you do have that sense. And I wasn't one of those people that felt like I'd lost myself or anything. I felt very much, I was like, oh, I'm just me, but now I also have a baby and there you go. But I think you have more of a sense of time pressure. I think you've got someone to prove something to, and you definitely do not want your identity to sort of, and don't get me wrong, obviously, you know, being a mother is a big expensive thing, but I'm very, very much don't want my identity externally presenting to be that I am a mum, and that's what I am, and that's who I am, and what I do, and things like that.
I agree entirely. I also think it's mortality, like, to go even deeper into the pop psychoanalysis. Like, I think that there's nothing like having a kid to make you go, wow, I'm no longer the youngest generation in my family. Like, I'm, you know, I've moved up that, speaking of ladders, I've moved up that ladder. And I just started to go, wow, well, I've always told myself I'm going to write. Wow, like, when? Like, when am I going to do it? And it frustrates me so much, because that absolutely coincides with a moment in time when you feel like you do have no time.
And that's it. Time becomes a premium. So you realize that you are not going to just sit down 1 week while you're freelancing and go, my novel just came to me and I sat there for a week with endless pots of tea. You go, oh, if I want.
If I want this to happen, I have to do it. Yeah.
That's right. So you started writing again once you had your kids. You're squeezing it into the cracks type of person, or do you set time aside?
No, I don't set time aside. I'm not that structured, and I don't work full time. I work 4 days a week, and then I have my younger child is 3, so I have Wednesdays with him at home, which is, you know, that gives me even less time for writing than my other day. So no, there's not a lot of time. But look, I think I write in fits and starts, I guess. So I will go for weeks without really writing much, and then I will be seized with inspiration, and I will just try and smash something out as fast as I possibly can, which is, I think, why I write picture books, because they are quite short generally. And I it doesn't mean that they're easy to write, but I find that they are fast to write. I've started dabbling a bit in short stories too, which are kind of fulfilling that same, they're ticking the same box in that they're not easy, but they're short.
That's amazing. Short stories terrify me more than anything.
Because the idea of a novel terrifies me more than anything.
I did some creative writing in one of my masters, and it was when we had to do short stories, it just made my skin crawl. It's too much pressure to try, and I like being able to sit in my brain and think about the people and think about all these amazing, like, bits of color and detail. And I say this as someone who's never finished one of my novels, but but I like that. I enjoy it, and it seems doable. If someone said, please write me a short story that's not a kid's picture book, I would I'd rather write 10,000 words. If they said, write 10,000 words or a week to write a short story, I would pick the 10,000 words.
you could probably create some real theory about how different people's brains work based on their kind of genre of choice to write in.
Yeah. Maybe. So you mentioned your middle grade. How much work are you doing on that at the moment?
Oh, look, at, you know, zero. I'm writing a short story at the moment that might be a middle grade, or maybe even YA short story. I tend to write bits and pieces, and then I will leave it. And then if I'm still seized with inspiration when I open the file again, then I know that I'm onto something. So the kind of longer stuff that I'm trying to write at the moment is in that sitting and stewing on my computer for the stage while I while I get distracted with other shorter things.
I was just about to say, do you ever find that you have too many ideas and that you can't focus or you can't pick one in a productive way?
Not really. I guess I just follow what inspires me. So if I lose interest with a particular story, I'm literally just going to leave it and probably nothing will ever come of it again. So the only things that I complete and send out on submission are things that still excite me by the time I've edited it, by the time I've gone through however many times. So I do have trouble with it, but it just means that that particular piece of writing I have decided is not good enough and I won't even bother with it, which is probably quite terrible because there's probably still something in it and, you know, it's a very wasteful way to work. But when you write short things, you can do that, I guess.
Do you find if you get, we talked about creative block a little bit before, so if you have a story and you feel like there's a gap or something missing or incomplete, will you go away and leave it and let your subconscious sort of percolate on that, or do you actively work at it to solve the problem and find the gap?
I'd probably have a different answer if I had a different writing process that was more structured, but because I'm only writing in the cracks, I'll always leave it and go away because I'm not wasting that precious like 15 minutes of time trying to figure out something that I haven't already figured out in my head. Yeah, I'd say I do a lot more thinking while, you know, while walking around or while, you know, or, you know, cleaning the house. Not that my house is very clean at all. Like, or putting away clothes or whatever. That's when the thinking happens.
There's, again, completely unqualified to make this claim, but I am pretty sure that there's a lot of research about that, that, you know, moving your body and walking and things like that really does tap into and helps you access, you know, different parts of your creative brain. So
I think it
there's
does.
Something in that.
I totally agree. I'm a big walker. I think that's as much as a part of my writing process as anything, really.
So you had two picture books out in quite quick succession, and then you've got a few more in the pipeline, and that is, I would suggest by anyone's standards, quite successful. But we spend a lot of time in social media where you get to see a lot of other people's successes, and we do tend to share rejections in, you know, critique groups and so on. But how do you find seeing other people's successes sort of impact your feelings about your own, you know, work as an author, or how well you're doing, or whether you're doing it fast enough and all of that kind of thing?
Yeah, look, I love being part of a kind of social media writing community. Like, I feel like I wouldn't be doing it nearly as conscientiously if I didn't have a community on social media who I knew were going through the same things at the same time. But that said, I tend to go on social media in kind of fits and starts. And then the same way I write. But then every single time I realize that I've gotten myself either into a bit of a spiral of looking at other people's success, about whatever it reflects on my lack of success, quote unquote, at the same time, which is ridiculous. But I also find that it is a time thief. Like, I never know when to stop commenting on like a comments thread, like when someone responds to me, and when do I stop? Like, do I do it just doing like a thumbs up, or is that rude? Yeah. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's that kind of thing. And the other thing is that, like, I love seeing other people's success on social media, but I always remind myself, and I'm getting better at this, I always remind myself that people are at different life stages and different life circumstances. Like, for example, like, I still have so much trouble getting to writing events at the moment, just because, like, I'm still at a stage where at least my little kid, like, he's still like quite needs me a lot, like, so getting it away to things and getting out to things can be quite difficult. And so, like, the other day I got sent through the final proofs for my next picture book, and I was so stoked. I was looking at them, I was nearly crying, I was so happy. And then I closed the tab and I get onto Instagram, and I saw some people at like a bunch of different writing events that I'd wanted to go to, but I couldn't because, you know, like work and kids and stuff. And I instantly went from elation to feeling like crap, which I think was just, it actually happened. I knew that I'd be talking to you, and I thought, I need to remember this because it's an object lesson in the fact that you need to remember that social media has its own context, and that if you make it affect the way that you're feeling in the moment about your own circumstances without any reflection on the context, then, you know, that way madness lies.
That's one of the checks I put on myself now. I go, do you think you are going to feel better or worse about yourself if you look at this for exactly the same reasons that you've just discussed?
Yeah, look, I think it's a universal experience. And so, like, my day job is in advertising. And I mean, I'm under no illusion that the role of these platforms is to keep us on it and keep us scrolling and looking for that dopamine hit. Like that's the way they make money, right? So I need to remind myself that this is designed to be addictive. This is designed to make you feel bad and want to keep going looking for something that will make you feel better. And I need to make myself get conscious of that all the time that I'm using it. So I mean, look, I think in balance, I think it has added to my life rather than subtracted, because I wouldn't have be part of this amazing writing community otherwise. But yeah, it's really important to be mindful of that.
I think it's that old adage that, you know, can walk and chew gum type of thing. I always think about the you see friends and, you know, again, a lot of my writer friends are social media friends whom I wouldn't have otherwise, but you see their success and you are really genuinely very, very pleased for them. But it's such a quick step to then also feel, oh, it's not me. It's, you know, it's, I haven't been submitting enough. Even if it's not that you, it's not typically that you look at their work and go, oh, I can do better than that or anything. It's feel I'm not doing enough. It's that ridiculous hustle kind of culture that it feeds into. And again, you talked about circumstances that you go, maybe they're in a different position, or you don't know how long they've been working on that story, but you do feel like, you're not doing enough. Like the events, I can completely resonate with that idea that you feel like you need to be out there, and it's so incredibly hard with kids and work and...
Even sometimes getting to kids events, because I mean, the benefit, I guess, with writing for kids is that the book events are for kids generally, but even then it's a challenge. I think also, like you mentioned hustle culture, which I think has a lot to answer for, because I think in a way hustle culture is actually the opposite of the headspace that you need to be in to write something creatively, at least for me. And I feel like the more I'm going, oh, I should be getting in contact with this, you know, with this body about this event, and I should be getting in touch, I should be updating my website on this. The more I do that, I feel like the more I get distracted from doing the actual writing, which, you know, for better or worse, I guess.
And I think it's really easy. I recently read Anna Funder's Wifedom. I don't know if you've read that.
I haven't read that one, but I've read her other books. Yeah.
Yeah, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, and her role as George Orwell's wife. And one of the big things that she talks about in the book, and when she talks about it, is that, you know, the conditions that having a wife, you know, allowed to create these, and those sort of genius writers of the 20th century, that you have such different conditions that you're trying to produce creative things in. And it's just... It's just not something that you can do, I think, you know, for anyone, men or women, in the, you know, these days, it's very hard to try and do that and keep up with all those other things, because you can't just be a writer and just write and then hope that everyone else will go out into the world and spruik you.
Yeah, exactly.
Writing included or writing aside, how do you define success?
Oh, I was thinking about this, and look, I actually think that true success is knowing that success, quote unquote success, is actually a social construct, and is reaching that point where you go, oh, like I don't need this version of success, whether it's the version that social media has told me is real or broader society has told me is real, because I have an internal idea of success and I've reached that. So yeah, does that make sense? Like I just think for me, success is knowing that I don't need those external trappings, that I don't need the next, I mean, and this is purely theoretical, but if ever I get to the point where I go, I don't need another publishing contract, I don't need another award, I don't need another accolade or a good review, whatever, I'm okay just as I am, that will be success. I'll let you know if I ever reach it.
I like that. I think, and that's one of the, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert and all those people who talk about writing, and that you have to enjoy the journey and you have to be able to do it anyway. But it is really hard to distance yourself from that. You say, yes, I do, and I love my story, and I love writing, and I hate writing, and I love it. But you still want those things, and it is hard to separate that from.
I guess what I do want to say, though, is that, like, I thinking about it, like that is you have to come from a real place of privilege to say that, because I mean, but you also have to come from a place of privilege to be able to risk the amount of time that you're spending at writing, possibly to no avail, to do that in the first place. So I feel like there's plenty of people out there, I'm sure, who would love to be able to say, I don't need the external trappings of success. I don't need any of these kind of socially ordained markers of success, I'm okay myself. But they might be, you know, they might, you know, be struggling to pay their mortgage. They might be struggling to pay their kids and so on. So I think, yeah, it's a hard kind of balancing act to, I think, follow. Not that many writers are making a huge amount of money from writing, and that is its own, I think, issue in itself. But yeah, I feel like a lot of these ideas about success are kind of also things that we need to think about in the context of privilege.
Yeah, absolutely. There was one of the Kardashians, I want to say, came under fire maybe a year or so ago for saying this, you know, everyone just has the same 24 hours. And there were so many activists came out and said, people do not have the same 24 hours if they're working this amount, they have travel, they have these obligations.
Absolutely, yeah. The
time pool, energy, capacity. This is completely, complete rubbish.
You're absolutely right. I think in order to take the risk of any kind of creative endeavor that doesn't have a guaranteed outcome, you have to be in a position where you know that you're going to be able to put food on the table. Like, you know, I say all this saying, oh, success is knowing that you don't need success. I say that from a position where I know that, you know, my family is not going to be homeless if I don't get the next book contract.
Glamorous things like, oh, I just got my royalties, let's get the carpets clean or the couches cleaned.
I actually bought with my first royalty check, I bought a chair, but like not just I bought a reading check. So I was like, I'm going to buy something thematic. And I've literally wanted this particular armchair for years and years and years. I hadn't been able to justify it. I went, stop this, I'm going to do it.
Oh, that's really cool.
Now my kids love sitting in it. I don't actually use it, but
My big thing was that, again, when you talk about justifying your relative thing, I always said, when I get a book contract, I want to go and stay. We have a Palazzo Versace hotel on the Gold Coast. I said, I want to go stay there, but it has to be two nights so you can enjoy it for a day. And it's been rebranded now, so that's not going to happen. But then my first book was a picture book, and I was like, I don't think I can justify that.
Maybe it'll get turned into a movie and then
you know. My advance was not enough for two nights at Palazzo Versace.
So. No, exactly. Exactly. Unfortunately. Maybe one day.
Yes. It'll be a bidding war.
Yeah, totally.
It happens. And, you know, like, it again, if you do the work, you know, why not you, I guess?
I like that attitude. I mean, I think it's like there's all these things that you can't aim for, but if they happen along the way, that's still nice. They can't be what you're setting your sights on because you will go insane.
Yes. What's next for you and your writing journey?
In purely practical terms, so I have two books that are out in 2024. So two picture books. The first is The Truck Cat, which is out, I believe, end of March through Hardy Grant. I'm really pumped about that. That was the one that the other day I saw the final proofs and pretty much was just sobbing at my computer. I'm so happy. So that's illustrated by Danny Snell, who is just like jaw-droppingly good. The amount that he can communicate through an image with body language, even a cat's body language, is extraordinary. So I'm pretty happy about that. And then in, I believe, the end of July or thereabouts, I have another picture book out, and that will be through Affirm, and it's called 100 School Days. So that is about the 100 days of prep or kindy or whatever you call your first year of school celebration. And that will be illustrated by Laura Stitzel. Yeah, it's going to be a big year for me. So yeah, I'd better take off my introversion hat and put on my extroversion hat. Get ready to talk to people. Yeah, so I'm pretty excited about those. But also, look, I'm just continuing to potter around with more writing. Also, still mostly picture books, but like I said, I'm starting to delve into short stories a bit more. And they might be short stories for kids. I'm not entirely sure yet.
And if people want to keep an eye on your upcoming books, where can they find you?
My website is probably the best place, which is Deborah Frenkel, DeborahFrenkel, com. Or on Instagram, my handle is @DebDoesWords, or one word.
Thank you so much for your time, Deb. It's been great to talk to you on All the Ways I've Failed.
No, thank you so much for making this podcast. It's been great to chat.
Thank you for listening to All the Ways I've Failed. You can find details about our guests and their work in the show notes, and you can find me on Instagram at All the Ways I've Failed or at Beck Marshall Say. Please rate and review wherever you listen to podcasts so that others can hear the beautiful and generous stories of our wonderful guests.